Welcome to a new deep dive. Today we are unpacking a stack of sources, articles, research data, and mostly the Western Cape's 2020 to 2025 environmental implementation plan. And I know normally an environmental PDF sounds like, you know, the perfect cure for insomnia.
Right. Yeah, it really does.
But our mission today is to actually dig into this specific document because, well, it reads less like bureaucracy and more like a high-stakes survival guide for a region that is juggling all these interconnected crises. If you live anywhere affected by climate shifts, you really need to hear this.
Yeah, the context of these sources is just crucial because you really can't understand this plan without looking at the environment that forged it, right? So this is a region that was just staggering out of a brutal multi-year drought from 2014 to 2017.
Oh man, and right in the middle of that recovery, they just get hit with COVID-19.
Exactly, a massive compound disaster. And the document introduces a pretty chilling term for this dynamic. It calls climate change a disaster maximizer.
A disaster maximizer, wow.
Yeah, it doesn't just act alone. It multiplies the threats that are already on the board. So things like coastal storm surges, wildfires, severe water scarcity, they all just feed into and amplify one another.
I mean, it's like trying to rebuild your roof while the hurricane is still directly overhead. You can't just react to the emergency, you know? But how does a government actually move past just reacting and plan for a future with a disaster maximizer?
Well, that's why this plan aligns so deeply with the UN Sustainable Development Goals, or the SDGs. The core realization they had is that economic growth, social inclusion, and environmental protection are basically the exact same fight. You really can't fix one without the others.
Wait, I have to jump in here because SDGs usually just feel like, I don't know, corporate buzzwords to me.
Yeah.
Does this regional plan actually give those goals teeth? Or is it just lip service to international standards?
No, it absolutely gives them teeth. And it does so by moving away from, like, traditional environmentalism. Take the gender mainstreaming section in the sources.
Right. Here is where it gets really interesting to me. Because when I think of an environmental plan, I think of, you know, planting trees, not housing zoning, and gender equity.
Exactly. But the data clearly shows that environmental degradation hits women disproportionately harder, especially in rural areas. So the government actually mandates tracking strict metrics, like the number of finance opportunities provided to female students in the environmental sector.
Okay, but I want to make sure I'm following the logic here. We're funding students. How exactly does a finance opportunity for students stop a wildfire or mitigate a drought?
Well, by putting financial power and environmental education into the hands of women in rural communities, you empower the exact demographic that physically manages the local agriculture and water gathering. I mean, they are the ones on the ground.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, by resourcing them directly, they become the frontline defense against drought and resource scarcity.
That completely flips the script. You're building resilience into the social fabric itself rather than just, you know, building a higher seawall.
Precisely. And that exact same mechanism drives their inclusionary housing policy. So historically, environmental governance was very command and control. Regulators mostly just telling industries or citizens, you know, don't dump this, don't build there.
Right, just strict rules.
Yeah. But this plan uses proactive urban planning as a literal climate defense.
How so? Because when I think of housing regulations, I just think of city zoning boards. Not really climate shield.
Well, the government is using the regulatory process of planning permissions to leverage private developers. Like, if a developer wants to build a lucrative project, they are required to help create well-located, affordable spaces within that development. It is a strategy they call spatial transformation.
So instead of forcing vulnerable populations to commute from these poorly resourced outskirts, where I imagine they're much more exposed to floods and fires, integrating affordable housing into well-developed areas physically removes them from the path of that disaster maximizer.
You nailed it. A socially integrated, safely housed population is just inherently more resilient to a systemic shock than a divided, economically vulnerable one. They are using spatial transformation to build social cohesion.
So true environmental resilience is actually about building stronger, more equitable human communities. Mm-hmm. If the social system is weak, the disaster is maximized.
Exactly. The environment isn't just the forest or the ocean. It's, you know, the homes we live in, the economies we rely on, and the social structures that keep us safe.
Which brings us to a pretty massive paradigm shift to leave you with. if a regional government now recognizes that housing regulations and gender equity are critical environmental defenses against a disaster maximizer, how might that change the way you evaluate the climate policies in your own city?
Yeah, is the true role of a future climate scientist going to look a whole lot less like a meteorologist and a whole lot more like an urban sociologist?
Something to think about the next time you look at your city's skyline. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.